Friends, if there's one word that hangs above Ezekiel 36, it is this, the word failure. Failure. It's not a word that I like to say. It's certainly not a word that I like to be associated with my life. I don't meet my sales goals at work. Failure. I fight with my wife over something silly. Failure. My children grow up and move away and don't call me and don't even go to church. Failure. My boss calls me into his office because he knows that something's not quite right and wants to know what it is. And I know what the problem is. It has to do with me. Failure. I get into an argument with my neighbor over something really silly. Failure. Or I fail to get along with people in the church and we squabble about difficult and perhaps not very important things. Failure again. In one way, we become better at thinking about failure and covering it up the better the older we get. We simply learn to live with the failures that become part of our life. We don't talk about it, perhaps. We don't share it with other people. We just deal with them, perhaps gloss them over and move on to the next thing. To be human in our world is to be those who fail. But it's one thing to talk about failure in regard to us. It's quite another to talk about it in regard to the ancient future mission of God that we've been talking about in this series of sermons. Is it right? Is it even appropriate for us to say that the mission of God at a point in history meant failure? And what I'm going to suggest to you this morning is, in one sense, that is absolutely true. That is what we find, for example, in Ezekiel chapter 36. And yet in another way, this failure that we read about in this chapter is no failure at all. In fact, we are here this morning as recipients of not the failed mission of God, but as God's mission fulfilled. And so here this morning, what Ezekiel says to us about the ancient future mission of God and its somewhat failed task in history. In order to understand what I mean by mission failure, I want to take you to the time in which Jesus lived. To go and ask someone who lived, an average Israelite, about the kingdom of God and the nation of Israel and how successful this kingdom of Israel was. If you were an average Israelite in the time that Jesus lived, I could have asked you, for example, about political power. Look, friend, at the nation of Israel. How is Israel doing? Does it have the power to rule itself? And if your friend, the Israelite, was honest, he would say, well, we have a king of sorts. But the king has no actual political or military power. In fact, the nation of Israel as a nation really is no nation at all. We are so thoroughly governed by the Romans that whatever they say we have to do. The nation of Israel politically and militarily is a failure. And you might press on and say to your friend, then how is the nation of Israel doing in terms of its worship? How is the nation of Israel in regard to its ability to worship the God who is? And again, if your friend was being honest with you, he would say to you, if I look at the temple and its worship and our ability to worship as we want, it doesn't look that good. In fact, you remember the Sanhedrin, the mighty Sanhedrin, when Jesus was being tried. Who did they have to appeal to in order to execute the sentence? They could not do it by their own ecclesiastical power. They had to do it by appealing to the Romans. Again, as a nation of Israel, they failed to have religious power and religious fidelity at the time in which Jesus walked on this earth. So that if your Israelite friend were talking to you, he would say politically, civilly, in terms of the church, the nation of Israel appears to be a failure. If I could just confirm that to you with one other reference. If you think forward to the beginning of Acts, Jesus is about to ascend into heaven. His disciples have a pressing question for Jesus before he leaves. They say to Jesus, will you at this time restore the kingdom to whom? To Israel. Why do they ask that question? The question is so pressing in their minds because they look around at Israel and they say to themselves, obviously the kingdom has not been restored. Israel appears to be a failure. Jesus, will this be your final deed on earth before you leave? And remember what Jesus says. This is not the time, and that is not the correct question to be asked. But you can understand how the Israelites would have asked it and why they would have asked it. And it has everything to do with what we read about here in Ezekiel chapter 36. It appears the nation of Israel had failed. To understand why they thought that was the case, I have to lay out for you the history of how they arrived at Ezekiel chapter 36. Now, some of you will think to yourselves, I already know the history of Israel. I already know the Old Testament. But if you say that to yourself, I want you to still listen. Because I'm guessing that you may have not thought about the history of Israel through the lens that we are using in this series of sermons. If you think all the way back to the beginning of human history, Adam and Eve were created in this world, not for the sake of themselves, but for the sake of God. And the rebellion against him was not only a rebellion against the laws that God had made, which were very few at the time, easy, we might say, to keep track of, but they rebelled not only against the law, they rebelled against God. And God, in his kindness to them, said, I will reverse the curse that is being placed upon you because of my rebellion. And if you fast forward many years, you arrive in Genesis chapter 12, a chapter that a few weeks ago, hopefully, I explained to you in terms of the mission of God. And at the center of the calling of Abraham, this man through whom God was going to bring the line through whom Jesus Christ would come, he says to Abraham, this is why I'm calling you. I'm calling you from a land to a place you have never likely been, whose language you don't know, whose customs you don't know, whose culture is entirely foreign to you. I'm calling you to leave your land and go there for this reason. He says to Abraham, and I will bless you, and I will cause you to be a blessing to all the nations of the earth. And that phrase, blessed to be a blessing, stands not only over Abraham's life, it stands over the life of his children and his grandchildren and all of those who came from that line, including these Israelites that are found here in Ezekiel chapter 36. Now, I am delighted to review one thing from that sermon with you this morning, because I have to tell you, it hit me like a lightning bolt when I prepared that sermon a few weeks ago. At the very center of that chapter, Genesis chapter 12, is the word blessing. It is a reverse of the curses we find in the first chapters of Genesis. And it has a very specific meaning, this word blessing. In fact, I'm tempted to ask you, do you remember what blessing means? And the reason I want to ask you that is because I don't want you to forget that. Because blessing in the Bible is more than just favor. It's more than just God being nice to us. No, when God says, I promise to bless you, what he means is, I intend to reverse the effects of the curse. I mean to take this world that now has been radically affected by sin, and I want to reverse the effect of that. And I want to do that by demonstrating to you that I am God, I will take care of you, I will be with you. And as I reverse the curse of the fall in your life, I want you to be the instrument through which that blessing comes to all those who are around you. So that in Genesis chapter 12, the beginning of that chapter, you have the mission of God for the Old Testament Israelites explained in a way that every one of them would have understood, including those who are now in Ezekiel 36. But if you know your Old Testament, you will know that the Israelites did not respond in faithfulness to that calling. Not at all. In fact, the portions that I've been reading out of in Isaiah this morning are found from a prophet, found in a book from a prophet, who's writing to Israelites in captivity. Ezekiel is the same. We believe that Ezekiel never lived in the land of Israel. He was only a prophet in captivity. And he spoke to Israelites who were in captivity in Babylon. And what he said to them in this book is that you are receiving the punishment of God because you have failed in obedience to God's commands. And you have failed to be the people who are set aside to be a blessing to those who are around you. You have failed. And now God is determined to cleanse his people, to bring about a renewal in them, and to create for himself a people who are capable of doing what he has called in this world. And the Israelites knew that before liberation could finally come, things would probably get deeper and darker than they were already. It would be like a woman who is experiencing childbirth before the baby finally comes. There's pain and suffering and anguish. Or it would be like the darkness of night before the sun arises. So much darkness before finally the sunshine of renewal and change would occur. And the Israelites knew that when the day of renewal would finally dawn, Israel would be reborn as a new people, blessed to be a blessing to those who were in God's world. So again, if you were to speak to that man in Jesus' day, the average Israelite, it was that he would be looking for in the day when Jesus walked the earth. He was looking for a new people. He was looking for the renewal that God promised he would bring in order to reform the people who are capable of doing what God had called in this earth. Now, with that in mind, I want you to look at verses 16 through 24 of this passage. Because God there reviews his concern, first of all, for his holy name. Now, children, when God says his holy name, I don't want you to think to yourselves about the mistake that many of the Israelites today and in recent memory, going back a number of years, have made in regard to God's name. In fact, there's such a concern about the holy name of God that they've actually eliminated the vowels in his name so you can't say his name properly. And they have said to themselves, in that way we should revere the holy name of God. That's not what God means in Ezekiel chapter 36. He's not talking about the pronunciation of his name. In the Old Testament, when God talks about his name, what he means is, this is who I am, and my name represents me and what I do. So when he says, I have regard for my holy name, he is saying, I have regard for what I stand for who I am and what I've said I would do. It's a little bit like this. You may have a company business that has the name of the founder on the side of the vans and on the nameplate above the door when you walk in. And when the business owner turns over the business to his son or to his grandson, he will say to them, now don't besmirch my good name. He's not worried about the name on the side of the truck. He's worried about the reputation, what they stand for, what they try to accomplish. He's saying, be consistent. And this is God saying to the Israelites, because of my holy name, what I stand for, what I intend to do, you people have failed. And you have failed miserably. He says, when the house of Israel lived in their own land, they defiled it by their ways and with their deeds. They were impure. And they were impure in a way that made them ritually, that is, religiously impure. And he talks about blood being spread over their land in a way that defiled the land and ruined that land in its holy task to reflect God. And he says to the Israelites, in your rebellion against me, I scattered you among the nations. I was so concerned for my reputation and what I said I would do that I could not have you in my land representing me when you failed to be holy as I called. And so I sent you out, and I sent you out to be purified and to be refined and to live in a place until finally I could reform you and remake you into something good and beautiful. Again, that's the Old Testament. Now, when you read through Isaiah or Ezekiel, you may get the impression that the reason God sent them out is they simply failed to check the right boxes in terms of obeying his law. And if you read through the prophets very superficially, that's what you come away with. You abused the poor. You weren't just. You didn't honor the Sabbath. You were idolatrous. And yet if you dig down deeply into why the prophets were so concerned with how the Israelites lived, it was not simply because they failed to obey the right rules. If I could contrast this for a moment, There's a huge disparity between what God desires in the Old Testament about the way His people live and the way that many Muslim people, perhaps Muslim people we know, our neighbors, think about their obedience to Allah. For the Islamic person, they say to themselves, I do the right things, I obey Allah, I follow Him, because that's the right thing to do. He tells me, I do it, it is right. And if I do all these right things, Allah may simply wink at the difficult things that I do, the trying things, the wrong things, and He'll be happy with the things that I do that are right. When God in the Old Testament is speaking to His people, He is not speaking to them in that way. This is not a mathematical formula designed to bring about the right result. When God speaks to the prophets in the Old Testament about the Israelite rebellion, I want you to see that He is so much concerned for their holiness precisely because it reflects His reputation and His desire to do good in this world. I want to give you an illustration. I've used this illustration before. Some of you might chuckle when you hear this. In fact, I think I've used this illustration. If I had, please just smile and pretend like I'm not old and losing my memory. Shortly after we moved here, I needed a riding lawnmower. We have a larger place than we did before we moved here. And so this is probably a mistake. You can tell me about it later. But I looked on Craigslist, and there was a guy who was advertising a Bolin's lawnmower. He said it ran well. It was perfect. Come on over. Check it out. It'll all be fine. So that's exactly what I did. I drove there with my trailer. When I got there, he said, oh, something terrible has really happened. I tried to start it up. The carburetor doesn't seem to be adjusted right, and so it's not running very well. I'll knock off some money. Well, me thinking to myself, I have a son who can adjust that carburetor, no problem. I said, sure, I will take the lower price and I'll bring this thing home. Now, please smile because you know where this is going, don't you? When I got it home, my dear son and our neighbor, who knew everything about small engines, began pulling this thing apart and came to realize this was not adjustment on the carburetor. This was a serious internal engine problem. Rod, crank, bearings. The reason this thing didn't run well is because he was worn out. And on my forehead, evidently, was written the word sucker when I went to buy it. And he saw me and thought, I'll buy it. And he was right. Now, the reason I'm telling you that story is not because I was taken advantage of. That's happened a few times in my life. The reason I'm telling you this story is when I pulled up, he asked me about myself, and I said, I work at a seminary, all that kind of thing. And he said, great, I'm a Christian too. And after that engine was pulled apart, and I knew that he knew what was going on, I said to myself, no wonder people have a hard time believing Christians. I don't even like them right now. I tell you that story because the point of God telling the Israelites in the Old Testament to obey His law was not simply so they could check the boxes. It was so that when the other nations of the world looked at Israel, they would say, here is the place where God is. Here's where His name dwells. Here's a people who are being reformed by Him in a world of corruption. In a world where sin has radically distorted the world, here is a people who are being redeemed and set apart, a people who reflect the God who redeems. These people are blessed in the sense of Genesis 12, and they're capable of being a blessing to those who are around them. The nation of Israel, not to be trite, was set aside to be honest, to reflect the name of God. And in that regard, let me say this morning, the mission of God failed. Because that's not who they were. They became, and you can read in the Old Testament, your mind will blow. Your eyeballs will pop if you read the Old Testament prophets with that in mind. If you just look at the Old Testament prophets, and you ask yourselves, how would the nations around have viewed God and His mission in this world? When His people were like this, you're asking exactly the right kind of question, and it transforms the way you read the Old Testament. It's not about the rules. It's not about failing to simply keep the rules. It is about the failure of God's people to be a people who reflect God and His mission. Well, I say to you again this morning, in that sense, we can say, along with Ezekiel 36, the mission of God failed. But as I said at the beginning, it's not only that there's failure. It's also that the mission of God and a recreated people are anticipated here in Ezekiel chapter 36. And there I want you to look at verses 22 through 38. And obviously there's not enough time this morning. In fact, I've used up most of my time to explain to you what this means. But I'll simply tell you this. If you look here in Ezekiel chapter 36, he says in verse 26, "And I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules." What he is saying to the Israelites is, I see your failure, and I will recreate a people who will require the supernatural help of God in order to be what I want them to be. And if you fast forward in your mind to Acts chapter 2 and the pouring out of the Spirit of God, again, I suggest to you it is not simply about the Spirit being poured out for the sake of those people to be able to speak in tongues. The Spirit of God is not being poured out simply so that the promises of the Old Testament would be fulfilled. No, although those things are true, the Spirit is being poured out because God desires to reform a people for His mission in this world. He wants to cleanse them and renew them so they are capable of reflecting who God is and the holiness of His name. And when we read in Acts 2, that the people who are there not only spoke in other tongues to those who are from various parts of the world, what we have is a testimony and a fulfillment of exactly what Ezekiel prophesied, then the nations will know that you are God. How do they know? How do the nations know that God is who He claims? How is the holiness of His name defended? It comes in this. When the people see the recreated people of God and the reality of God's kingdom come in them, the promises that are made to the Israelites through Abraham, and the calling to be His people, are fulfilled through a recreated people called the church. There are a couple of ways, and I want to speak to this briefly, that we might get that wrong. And one of them already noted, I simply want to drive it home, and that is, when we think about the mission of God and our own holiness, that we've been recreated by God, a covenant community, to do His work in this world, we might misunderstand what that means in one of two directions. First, as I've noted already, we might think God's calling to us is simply to be a good and moral people. And as long as we are a good and moral people, we have done our job. As long as we do the things we're supposed to do, everything is okay. That's like taking one step and failing to see the big picture. It is not simply that we're called to be good and moral. I was talking this past week with a woman who was a Buddhist until recently. She said one of the major things you do in Buddhism, I had no clue. I've never been a Buddhist. I don't know much about it. She said you do what's called self-reflection. In self-reflection, you ask yourself the question, with the trouble in my life, where am I responsible and how should I change? She said, isn't that what Christians do too? I said, well, in a sense. Only the difference is this. Christians not only ask themselves that question, they also know that it's impossible apart from God's help to change fully. And there is a reason why that change occurs. Not simply so that they can be better and moral people, but so that God's work through them might come to pass. And she said, oh, I see. And I hope we do as well. Then when Ezekiel prophesies about this recreated people whom we are, he is talking about that recreation and that moral purity for the sake of the mission of God. The second thing that I would say we may miss when we think about our own holiness in this regard is that we think about our mission without holiness. If we might think about our holiness without mission, it might happen the other way around as well. And that is condemned in the Old Testament. I want to drive that home to you this morning. That Ezekiel 36 and its condemnation of the people of God is a condemnation that is rooted in the reality that they were not holy. We may fool ourselves into thinking it doesn't really matter what I do. As long as I say I'm a Christian, the way that I act and talk and believe doesn't matter. That's not true. It wasn't true in the Old Testament. It's not true now. Not understanding the connection between holiness and mission. That's one error. Not understanding that holiness is a prerequisite to mission is another serious error. And you will see, of course, in Ezekiel 36, as I read it, that the greatest condemnation falls on those who care little about their own holiness. But then I want to end this morning, having talked about the Old Testament people of God, the recreated Israel in the New Testament, I now simply want to draw your attention in anticipation of next week's sermon to the need for another Israel altogether. Because if we are honest with ourselves this morning, we may look at ourselves and say, we have been the recreated Israel, the people of God, set on the mission that He has given us. And yet again, if we're honest with ourselves, there are times when our covenant community looks a lot more like Old Testament Israel than we would want. And God knew that would be the case. So that in the prophecy of Isaiah, we have not only a recreated people, the church that is anticipated. Isaiah also talks about an entirely different Israel. That is his servant Israel, who would be pure and holy, and for whom the people of God could run to and be joined to in order to be equipped for this mission that God had given them. I would suggest to you that the Old Testament talks not only about a failed Israel and a new Israel, it also talks about the Jesus Israel. In fact, when you read the New Testament, you will see Jesus often redoing what the Israelites failed to do. Jesus goes down to Egypt after he is born and comes up as the Son of God. As the Son of God, the one who is the selected of God, holy God, to do the work of God. Jesus goes into the wilderness where the Israelites failed, and Jesus sustains the trials of the wilderness to prove that he is in fact God himself. In fact, the whole could be understood this way, that Jesus himself is the one who is necessary in order for the new, recreated Israel to be an Israel of faithfulness. In fact, to put it most concretely, it's only when we're joined to the Jesus who is able to work in us that the new Israel, that is us, we are able to do this work of God in this world. Next week, Lord willing, I'll look with you at Luke chapter 4, where Jesus himself claims this to be true. But for now, I simply want you to reflect on this reality. And I'll just review for you very briefly where we have been. That is, the Old Testament covenant Israel failed not because of their simple lack of holiness, but because of that lack of holiness reflected their failure to be God's people in this world and to pursue his mission. God, in his great desire to have his mission fulfilled, has recreated in Israel, that is, a church that carries the same banner, that has the same calling of God to be a blessing as we have been blessed. But even now, it is necessary for us as the new Israel to look to Jesus, who is able to fulfill what we lack in order for that mission to be accomplished. Friends, I hope as you reflect on this sermon in this coming week that it would not only shape your understanding of Ezekiel 36, really what I'm claiming, if I may do so rather humbly, is that the Old Testament should be read entirely in this way. And I hope that as you read the Old Testament, whether it's Ezekiel or Isaiah or Jeremiah or the Old Testament minor prophets, wherever it is that you read, you will come to see that the mission of God is foremost. It is front in what God is doing. And more than that, I would hope that as you view yourself, you would view this covenant community, you would view Jesus himself, you would see that these are not simply things that God is doing, but they're united. They're united under this great theme that God has called us to be a people of God, a mission, His mission in this world. Friends, may God grant His Spirit to us that we may know this and believe it. Amen.